Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. Once again, our guest is Selma Hepp. Selma is senior economist for the California Association of Realtors, a statewide trade organization with more than 100,000 members dedicated to the advancement of professionalism in real estate. Selma directs the activities of the association's research and economics group. She oversees the research and analysis of the housing market and economic trends, member and consumer surveys, and the impact of real estate-related regulatory and legislative policies. She earned her master's from SUNY at Buffalo and a PhD from the University of Maryland. And Selma, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Bruce.
You just opened the word that's California Association of Realtors' favorite word, affordability. So let's talk about that. We came from really numbers that I had never seen before in, say, 2011 and 2012, hovering in the mid-50s. And currently we are where in affordability?
We are at about 32%, I believe.
Okay. And historically...
Historically, yes, we are back in historical average. Yeah.
Yeah, we're in a healthy range. You know, I always, when somebody, I know, and CAR has a lot of those charts, which is, it's healthy. I mean, it's helpful to have that where it works out, where this is the median affordability, let's say. Mm-hmm. But 32%, it depends. If it's if you're going down from a higher number, to me, 32%. Is a very healthy affordability because you have a history of getting much lower. If you're going up from affordability that's lower on your way up, normally that accompanies markets that aren't doing well. Because at the end of the day, affordability is just a math computation on how much people were willing to pay for a property and the going interest rate. Mm-hmm. So you can have a very high affordability and still not have people want the product called real estate.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why we reached the level. So we dropped about 20 percentage points in the last couple of years. In the process, just to give you a sense of how many people are affected, with each drop in percentage point in affordability, we lose about 120,000 households that can qualify for a median price home in California.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
So with 20 percentage points, we are talking about 2.4 million people that cannot qualify for the median price home in California. But like you said, you know, when you compare house payments and minimum qualifying income from the peak until now, we're still technically in a quite affordable environment because at the peak we were looking, you know, the mortgage rates were different and house prices were different. So it's very relative when we're talking about this. You have to look at now in comparison to a couple of years ago or now in comparison to the peak.
Correct. Now, you said we've lost 2.4 million households that cannot qualify. Mm-hmm. That's due to the income that they're supposed to have, like whatever the median income is?
Yeah, and it also has to do with increasing mortgage interest rates.
Okay. But does inside of that 2.4 million households have to be existing homeowners? Would that be correct?
Yes. Well, exactly. So we also look at the same time first-time buyers. So calculation for that doesn't assume that they're able to come with 20% down, right? Because with those already existing homeowners, you would assume that they're able to come back with the 20% down.
Well, especially after 2013 helped them out. That's what's interesting to me and why I look at this affordability number and I go back and say, okay, 32%, that's to me a very healthy percentage. Because we usually head below 20% before we have a market really end. And mm-hmm. and usually when affordability goes down, volume of sales go up. So if you look at those two charts, it's hard for me to look at, okay, we've just lost 2.4 million households, and yet the volume continues to go up. So there seems to be a disconnect between as affordability declines, when you have volume of sales go up, maybe it's people that are moving up constantly. You're right. The first time buyer would certainly be mathematically eliminated first because they didn't gain any equity.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a broader question. When people buy a move up home, are they bringing most of the cash that they net from a sale to their next purchase? So the down payment sometimes far exceed 20% at that point?
Yeah, that's true. That's based on our survey, that's true.
Okay, so that's, again, it's just interesting that sometimes, you know, affordability, if you figured it one way, it looks very negative, and then you look at other charts and go, okay, well, nothing usually negative happens at 32% affordability. We usually go down and down and down until there's a breaking point, and it's just my belief that the breaking point is when enough lenders simultaneously have to say no to people that really don't qualify.
Mm-hmm.
But at 32%, I mean, we're in 2001 range, 1987, 1977, and they were followed by a very good year. So anyway, that was just part of whenever I look at that affordability chart, I just come to different conclusions than I usually hear from Carr. But that's what kind of why I asked you the question. When you have a room full of economists and you're doing research, there's got to be somebody going, I don't know that means that.
Yeah, it's true. They always say if you have 100 economists in one room, you'll have 100 different opinions.
And that's, to me, that's part of the fascination of trying to figure out, you know, what's next in our market.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we had touched on migration, and I think one of the important things, you know, you were talking about the affordability, it's also really got to be related to employment for California. It seems like the one industry that we really don't have clicking on all cylinders is construction.
Yeah,
and I think construction probably is a big driver of immigration to California. Is that historically true?
I think so. Yeah, I think this whole question around construction employment is very interesting, because from what I've heard from builders is a lot of the trouble in getting skilled workers is that those workers actually went to work on
oil.
In the oil fields and the whole new fracking technologies, North Dakota through Texas, you know, and that's where they lost most of those skilled people too. And this is something really interesting. I mean, this is something, you know, as a forecaster, as an economist, this is one of the things we cannot predict, you know, what's going to happen with that labor force. So we're definitely, when we lost in California, we had in comparison to the nation, we had a much more significant loss in employment, and we have not gotten to the levels nearly where, in comparison to the rest of the nation, and a lot of that is a lack of construction employment that hasn't come back.
And are the builders are saying they would build more if they had skilled labor?
Well, it's a lot of things, I think, for them. I think it's the skilled labor. There's California's regulatory environment.
Yes.
We have one, you know, if not the most stringent regulatory environment for builders. And then they are, I think they understand that the buyer that has been entering in the market is not the type of buyer they're looking for. So, like we talked about, it's institutional buyers and investors and foreign buyers, and that's not the market they're going after. So they're waiting for the traditional buyer to come back before they start ramping up their production.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you're going to ramp up production. Preceding that, you would have ramped up subdivision creation.
Mm-hmm.
And in Riverside, for I think at least 5 years running, and maybe six, subdivision creation is down 95%.
Yeah.
So whenever they decide to crank on the building, they're going to go through their existing lots, and there's going to be several years where there's a big hole in what they need and what they have.
Yeah. And when you look at the new construction, I mean new housing permits, the numbers, you know, it dropped after 2006-07, and then it's just been at that steady, very, very low level. So we are right now, let's say, at about, I don't know, 8,000 units being built, and we have about 15,000 household formation in the state. So we are definitely not building up to the sort of the demand, you know. And a lot of that building is coming in the multifamily sector and apartments, but not in the single family sector.
Well, let's talk about household formation, because it's interesting. If you do research like you and I do, you definitely see a shift in what comprises a household. You know, the assumption is that it's 2.3 kids and a married couple, and that's no longer true.
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely changed. The whole concept of household has changed, and I think, you know, I've read somewhere today in Wall Street. I just read the title. I didn't read the whole article. Something about looking for that Feds were look. Why the Feds missed the downturn is because they were looking at the wrong numbers. It may be that we are looking at the wrong numbers when we're talking about household formation. And I'm talking about this generally, because we don't know, we are seeing such a significant shift in what household means that we may be really completely missing the boat here in terms of when only looking at numbers. Because the numbers show us a drop, particularly in California, in household formation, and we, for example, from 2008 to today, we have formed some 600 fewer households than we would have created had we continued growing at the pace we were growing prior to the crisis.
Now you said 600.
Yeah, 600
okay.
fewer households.
Okay.
But this is, you know, these are numbers. I'm looking at the state's finance department numbers for households. So I don't know if they come up with those numbers by doing some multiplication somewhere else, or this is their projection using something else. You know, so I lost my train of thought, but
well, you know what's interesting is when you have a household that changes inherently what it is. So I think a fair amount of people that are households now are single.
Yeah.
So you've got one wage earner. So how you can qualify or what you can qualify for is really got to be very different than the traditional household.
Yeah. Exactly. And I think that's why. That may be part of the reason why we're not seeing a ramp up in single family activity, but in multifamily construction, because they are creating this at the moment. And another thing I heard is that they're building apartments that are to condo specs to cater to these young people now who are finally getting jobs, are going to move out of their parents' homes. But cannot yet afford a home, so they're going to go first to an apartment. 5 years down the road, hopefully their income situation and their saving, they're going to have some saving. So then they're going to be switching the apartment units into a condo unit. But they're already going to be, you know, condo ready,
right?
Because it's a very different type of construction. So I thought that was interesting.
It's to have kids that are about that age. You know, I really like that, because then I get Aaron, my son, to interview his friends. And so this echo boom generation has certainly been laggards when it comes to household formation. But I still believe that when it all comes down to it, they're going to want their own little piece of land and a single family house as opposed to a condo with a weight room down 20 stories. That would be my guess.
Yeah. I'm, you know, it's a hard call right now. We did a bunch of surveys on that, particularly of the renter survey. So, and we did one between, we did telephone calls and online surveys. And naturally, the population is going to be different on telephone calls versus online surveys, where you would get more younger people on the online surveys. And they are more interested in density. They're interested in density, and amenities really matter to them. But home ownership is still important to them. You know, they still strive to have something on their own.
Okay.
So in in urban planning discussions, we're talking about when people, they may be single for longer, but when they get to that point that they, you know, double up in the household, maybe have children, that's the point, the breaking point at which they're moving away from the condo into the single family home,
and,
whether it's a townhouse or whatever.
And for this generation, instead of happening at 21 and 22, it's happening at 28 and 29.
Exactly, exactly. That's the difference.
And so it's been a little while before they formed households. Now, on the other side of the equation, you have the maturing of the baby boom generation. Mm-hmm. And so typically, what do you look for when somebody goes from 65 to 75? Do they unown their big house and they look for something else? Is that going to be typical?
That's what we saw typically historically. But interestingly enough, it's not been happening this time around or in the last few years.
That actually makes perfect sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Only because I think, okay, what is this generation? It's sort of been, honestly, it's been catered to for their entire life, and I've been part of it.
Yeah.
And so do I really want to leave my big house to a little place with common walls? No, I don't.
yeah, exactly. And I think there are other things too. You know, why would you be now selling in the downturn? You know, if you have already paid off your house, maybe you're going to give half of that money to your kids if you, you know, downsize. Why would you be selling right now? So maybe, you know, so I think about that too when I'm thinking about why there's no inventory there and why baby boomers are still sitting out in their original long-term property that they've owned.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The first-time buyer, traditionally when you have a downturn and then you begin a comeback, so we've been in this comeback for now a few years, usually the first-time buyers, about half of the volume. And we're in the 30s somewhere, right, as far as first-time buyer participation?
Yeah. It's really that share has really dropped. Historically, we were about 40%, 38%. And our last survey showed 25%. So really significant drop. And we, you know, I don't think that since we've started tracking this number that we've seen that much of a drop.
Okay. Yeah, that's a big hole in the market. And I think one of the things that'll help is even though FHA has lowered their loan limits, they've gotten more aggressive with who they'll qualify. Because there's a chart that I think I got from one of your guys' presentations. It was or from an FHA report, but it showed in 2008, basically between the FICO score 560, I'd say, and 640, 60% of FHA's business fell within those FICO scores.
Yeah.
And now it's 9%.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically did away with half of their volume just by changing the FICO scores. And now we just saw emails saying they're back to 560. So I think you might have a resurgence in who they say yes to as first-time buyers, and that would be a big help.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I hope so, definitely for the first-time buyers. You know, one thing I keep thinking about with the, you know, 2009 tax credit, first-time buyer tax credit, that pulled in a lot of demand. Whether it pulled it forward,
yes,
meaning that those people would have bought eventually later, or whether it's that they stimulated some demand. It's something the economists debate about. But nevertheless, I mean, it just shows you how much $9,000 or whatever the credit was, how much does that help? Because survey after survey, what we're seeing that the biggest problem for these folks is the down payment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they have no problem affording the mortgage, but they cannot come up with down payment. They just don't have enough time. The time to save would take way too long.
Yeah, and you know, when you're trying to figure out policies, you know, one of the things they used to be able to do would be like have a Nehemiah fund where you could, that would fund the down payment like a gift, but mm-hmm. wouldn't be a relative. But I know that they look at that and say, well, a lot of our defaults came from that type of program. So it's hard to get you know, a policymaker to look at that and say, yeah, we'll go back to where we can have gift funds that aren't connected to a relative.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't, I mean, honestly, I don't know how I feel about that that idea around that. I think, I don't think the down payment in its, well.
I know what you're saying, and I agree wholeheartedly. If if you look at like one of the most successful loan programs, go back 50 years, it's the veteran with zero down. It doesn't have a down payment, but it has a better not a delinquency record than any loan that we have. So I guess it's perhaps who's loaning, who's borrowing the money, but also the loan process, whatever they're doing makes the loan safer than a down payment.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, also, you know, there are down payment assistance programs generally through the state, through local county and areas like that. And those were studies we looked at when we were, you know, when there was a lot of discussion about QRM and 20% down and what's that going to do. And this down payment assistance program all consistently show that when you educate people, because part of the requirement is to do education classes and sort of money management classes. And when you do those and the down payment programs are usually organized around contribution. So I, for example, I as a buyer contribute $100 and you give me $1,000 for every $100 I put. So I put something, but it doesn't take that long. You know, it accelerates the process. And I'm educated, I get financial literacy as a part of the process too. That the default rates are minimum. They were really, in comparison to all other products, they were minimum.
Yeah, and it would open the world up, not just to sales, which is, okay, if I'm a realtor, I would like sales, but the economics for that family going forward are very different.
Yeah.
They become a homeowner, and they have equity. Eventually, they may have an equity line that allows them to participate in other investments.
Yeah.
So it's a very big deal. It's a big difference in how things end up for that family going forward. Plus, they lock in their payment. Instead of their rent being adjustable and always going up, now they have a fixed housing cost, which is a very big deal of homeownership, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
We only have a couple more minutes. Let's talk about inventory, because I noticed from December to now, inventory's gone up from 3 months to over 4 months, and I do a lot of speaking, and people are concerned. Is most of that increase due to actual more listings there, or is it kind of due to sales not being as brisk as we thought they would be?
Yeah, it's exactly what the second thing you said. So this is you're talking about unsold inventory index, and it's an index, and basically it's a ratio of raw inventory to sales. And every time you have sales slowing down, the index itself is going, it goes up. So that's what we saw in this latest index going from 3-something to 4.3 months. That not necessarily that we're seeing that many more raw inventory, but just more, just fewer sales. But when we look at numbers, when we do look at raw inventory numbers at the aggregate level, so, you know, for the state as a whole, and a lot of times numbers get completely diffused when you look at the aggregate level, but we do have more inventory. We have about 10% year-over-year increase in inventory. But you are comparing it to a year ago when we were at absolute lowest. So 10% over that is not that much more. But there is a itty-bitty tiny increase in inventory. The unsold inventory increase index makes it look more than it actually is, though.
And in just about a half minute left, but what's significant is most of the sellers now are equity sellers, and when they sell theirs, they buy another.
Yeah.
So it's hard to see how that inventory level would be a significant down drag on price anytime soon.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I don't see that happening anytime soon.
All right. Well, we have about run out of time. Selma, I really want to thank you for joining us. Selma Hepp is the senior economist for the California Association of Realtors, and I think we're all looking forward to a pretty healthy 2014. So once again, thanks so much for taking time to join us.
Thank you very much, Bruce. It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.